It is 10 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 1 p.m. in the East Coast. It is 8 p.m. in the Middle East. Today, October 13, 2014, I am Orly Benny Davis on BBS Radio with The Impossible Truth. Today, I wanted to speak to one of the best speakers that I ever know, and the best one. His knowledge in his craft is supreme, and he can bring to light and it can change your life because your perspective is different from his. I think that he is one of the best, and we need to listen to him very carefully because his perspective makes sense, makes reason, and I'm very honored to welcome again Mr. John Villanueva to my show. John, welcome to my show.
Thank you for having me, Orly, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
You deserve it, sir. I know you, and you deserve it. And I'm very honored that you're here on our show. It's an important day in the history of humankind. We are faced with so many challenges, and we need to keep our opportunities and our priorities straight. And I'm sure that you have some different reasoning that we need to consider while doing this important choices and decisions.
Yes, Orly. I mean, one of the topics that I'd like to discuss today is America's place in the world, its current status, and its decline as a nation, and some of the things that we should really be concerned about because they're going to predict where we end up over the course of the next 20 years. And where America ends up is going to affect our closest allies, like Israel, right? Because our standing in the world directly impacts the standing of Israel in the world. And I'd like to focus on basically four areas. One is education, two is infrastructure, three is the spirit of entrepreneurship, and four, good governance and social justice in the United States. As you know, Orly, and you and I have talked in the past, the United States, in terms of education, is in decline. We are ranked 17th in the world. And wow. If you look at the top 10 countries in terms of education in the world, five of them happen to be in Asia, and these are countries that are thriving right now, South Korea, Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore. If you look at some of the others, Finland, Netherlands, New Zealand, and Switzerland, these are European countries where there's a tremendous investment in terms of not only education, but you see there's an investment in terms of infrastructure and an investment in terms of entrepreneurship. And you see laws changing within those countries that are leading to good acts in terms of governance and social justice. These are all things that contribute to countries being able to thrive in not only this century, but in the next century. And these are the areas that we seem to be falling short. And I think that they pose the greatest threat to our future. All of this focus that we have on ISIS and Ebola at this time, none of that is going to impact us as greatly as the deficiencies that we're experiencing in our hearing.
I hear you. I hear you. I think that we need to look into America and its role in the world, and we cannot lose sight of what is important, you know, making the next generation worth being a leader of the free world. Because we don't have only America, you know, as a state. We have America as the leader. And as a leader, they need to have the tools, the mechanism, and to know how to do things. And education is one of the methods that we definitely need to reinforce. America been lacking for so long. It's been... being considered to be the smartest, in many crafts. So there is no reason that with all that knowledge that our children, the people that learn in the United States, cannot bring about the best of mankind. In the 60s, they already sent the man to the moon, and for some reason, this gap of generation, this stuff did not bring it all together, and I wonder why you think it's the reason. Why we focus so much on the stuff that is outsourcing you know, the future of America, in other ways.
It's a trend now, which I think has been taking place over the course of the last 40 years, which is a divestiture in terms of education, and an increase in the funding not only for the military, but for an incentivized system for industries to move abroad. Right? I mean, outsourcing really came of age in the 1990s. Right, and we started to outsource manufacturing, and while we were sending all of these jobs abroad, we weren't doing a lot to really improve the quality of education at home, and this started to fall. And one of the things about education, and I just kind of want to build this quick link, that is, America is a great democracy. It's one of the greatest democracies, you know, in the history of the world. But democracies, right, require a high level of education and literacy to be sustained. You can't sustain a complex form of government on illiteracy, right, where you have the separation of powers between different institutions, where you have laws that basically dictate our behaviors and enable social progress. You can't sustain that on illiteracy. And one of the things that has happened is, as we see this decline in education, you also see this lack of civility in governance, right? I mean, if you look at the Congress of the United States today, it looks like one very dysfunctional body. And if you listen to the politicians on television, and if you read their press clippings, and if you hear their arguments, they sound like buffoons. And that's not an accident. They're pandering to an audience which they perceive to be uninformed, and an audience that is not holding them accountable. 40 years ago, it would have been unthinkable to elect some of the people to public office that we've elected to public office today. In some ways, we've made tremendous gains in terms of minority representation. In other ways, we've suffered tremendous losses in terms of losing people who could actually think, who were honest brokers of power in this country. If you think back to people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, somebody who used to make decisions based on research, based on how he felt the country would be impacted over the course of years, and then you compare him to some of the people we elect into office today, there's no comparison. There are no intelligent arguments being made by many of the people who represent us in government. But the worst part of that is that on the constituent side, on the American citizen side, there are no serious demands being made of its government. And the reason, I believe, is because people, not only is it a question of literacy, but it's a failure to understand the implication of electing incompetent people to office to run the world's greatest republic and democracy.
Absolutely.
We have an uninformed constituency being led by an even more uninformed elected body.
Absolutely. I think that people also are disenchanted with the old system, because it's failing them. It's failing them day in, day out. And, you know, with the collapse of the economy since 2008, they've been on their own. The fact that the elected official were saying hello in the city hall did not make a difference for them. They needed somebody who can solve the problem. And for some reason, many people just dragged their feet. They didn't make a true change in the course of action. They didn't take control. They let the globalized economy, eat every good part of the U.S. economy, and they exported most of the capability of America overseas, and look at China. She's growing and growing, and all the wealth was moved to her, and we don't even correct. Listen, we didn't even correct those laws in the book that accommodate such a state, which every legislator had to do, because once you had China as the preferred economy to do business with, when she's taking over the global economy, you needed to correct that and let her pay taxes. Because right now, America owes so much to China that they can do anything with our with our global economy. They can change it. They can make America poor, and if they enforce it, and once you know, they can bankrupt the system. So we have to correct it, and those legislators need to take action right now. But as you know, are they capable of? Are they good enough to do the job? I like them a lot. They're nice, but you know.
I would offer this. China, right? China's a manufacturing behemoth. But the reason that they're a manufacturing behemoth, and there are others in Asia which are becoming manufacturing behemoths, is because somewhere, you know, I said education, entrepreneurship, infrastructure, good governance, and social justice. But there's another component, too, and that's ethics. Industry, for whatever reason, feels that it's the only way it can prosper is if others fail. And I don't mean fail literally. I mean fail in terms of an expectation of a standard of living that we as Americans would accept. Industry has been chasing poverty. It goes into poor countries where there are no environmental or labor laws, where people can be worked for 50 cents an hour for 10 hours a day, and where the environment can suffer tons of pollutants, and then they export those finished goods to the United States, where they're sold as a premium to the largest consumer market in the world. But so we're chasing poverty, and if another country can manufacture cheaper, we'll move to that country. But we could actually both boost our economy and have an international global impact on the world if we just implemented one law, and that is that if you manufacture a product or offer a service and you're exporting that into the United States from another country that does not share our standard of living, meaning, you know, has to abide by all of the same laws to manufacture a product or how you treat your workforce as we do, then we're going to tax it to make it the equivalent of what it would have cost to manufacture here. If that were to happen early, all of that manufacturing would move back to the United States.
Yeah, it will
and
level
you'd
the boom
in this economy. But we won't do that. Politicians won't do that. And the reason they won't do that is because they're not really thinking of what is in the best interest of this country and its citizens. They're thinking only in terms of in what's the best interest of the multinational corporation. And they've put the multinational corporation ahead of the citizen. And because of that, as a country, that's why we experienced 2008. The recession of 2008, the bank disaster that happened in 2008,
that is
a direct result of a lack of legislative oversight and laws that were applicable to the banking industry that had directly affected the consumer. They were basically basically gambling with American debt, with American investment, America's wealth. And when they lost the money at the casino, they transferred that debt onto the taxpayer, and the taxpayer had to pick up the bill. And no one was held to account. Now,
one of the reasons nobody was held to account
was because the laws didn't exist to hold them accountable. But that wasn't accidental. That was intentional. And that has something to do with the ethics of good governance that we have in this country. And the American public, that it didn't understand what was happening, how it happened, why it happened, and who should be held accountable, that has a lot to do with us being poorly educated in terms of how the financial markets work, and in terms of what our government is doing on our behalf to monitor those markets.
I second that, John. It's really, really sad thing that we have to face this incredible debt, national debt in America, and everybody has to chip in instead of giving the bill to all those countries that enjoyed American protection and America, policing all over the world on American expense. I said it before, and whoever wants to correct the national debt have to go to those nations that benefit from it and start sending them the bill, because it's time. And education is to know how to do it. Education is to know what to do with this incredible crisis. John, this is incredible topic, and we should talk and analyze it further, you know, and get some guests maybe to debate it with you one day. I do have incredible feature after. I wanted everybody to listen to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech on the United Nations, another Roxanne Morin, body that protect the human rights of people, but then defends Hamas, you know, today in the eyes of the world. So I think that we need to give Benjamin Netanyahu's speech time and consideration. And I know that we have so much to talk about more. And thank you so much for honoring me and coming to the show. All the best to you and your lovely, lovely family. I wish you all the best, and I hope to talk to you soon, okay? God bless you, John.
Thanks to you, Orly. Thanks for having me on. I always enjoy speaking to you.
Thank you, sir. Let's go to a break.
Distinguished delegates, I come here from Jerusalem to speak on behalf of my people, the people of Israel. I've come here to speak about the dangers we face and about the opportunities we see. I've come here to expose the brazen lies spoken from this very podium against my country and against the brave soldiers who defend it.
Right. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, the people of Israel pray for peace. But our hopes and the world's hopes for peace are in danger. Because everywhere we look, militant Islam is on the march. It's not militants, it's not Islam, it's militant Islam. And typically, its first victims are other Muslims, but it spares no one. Christians, Jews, Yazidis, Kurds, no creed, no faith, no ethnic group is beyond its sights. And it's rapidly spreading in every part of the world. You know the famous American saying, all politics is local? For the militant Islamists, all politics is global, because their ultimate goal is to dominate the world. Now that threat might seem exaggerated to some, since it starts out small, like a cancer that attacks a particular part of the body. But left unchecked, the cancer grows, metastasizing over wider and wider areas. To protect the peace and security of the world, we must remove this cancer before it's too late. Last week, many of the countries represented here rightly applauded President Obama for leading the effort to confront ISIS. And yet, weeks before, some of these same countries, the same countries that now support confronting ISIS, opposed Israel for confronting Hamas. They evidently don't understand that ISIS and Hamas are branches of the same poisonous tree. ISIS and Hamas share a fanatical creed, which they both seek to impose well beyond the territory under their control. Listen to ISIS self-declared caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. This is what he said 2 months ago. A day will soon come when the Muslim will walk everywhere as a master. The Muslims will cause the world to hear and understand the meaning of terrorism and destroy the idol of democracy. Now listen to Khaled Mashal, the leader of Hamas. He proclaims a similar vision of the future. We say this to the West: by Allah, you will be defeated. Tomorrow, our nation will sit on the throne of the world. As Hamas's charter makes clear, Hamas's immediate goal is to destroy Israel. But Hamas has a broader objective. They also want a caliphate. Hamas shares the global ambitions of its fellow militant Islamists. And that's why its supporters wildly cheered in the streets of Gaza as thousands of Americans were murdered in 9/11. And that's why its leaders condemned the United States for killing Osama bin Laden, whom they praised as a holy warrior. So when it comes to their ultimate goals, Hamas is ISIS, and ISIS is Hamas. And what they share in common, all militant Islamists share in common. Boko Haram in Nigeria, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Al-Nusra in Syria, the Mahdi army in Iraq, and the Al-Qaeda branches in Yemen, Libya, the Philippines, India, and elsewhere. Some are radical Sunnis, some are radical Shiites. Some want to restore a pre-medieval caliphate from the 7th century. Others want to trigger the apocalyptic return of an imam from the 9th century. They operate in different lands. They target different victims. And they even kill each other in their battle for supremacy. But they all share a fanatic ideology. They all seek to create ever-expanding enclaves of militant Islam, where there is no freedom and no tolerance, where women are treated as chattel, Christians are decimated, and minorities are subjugated, sometimes given the stark choice: convert or die. For them, anyone can be considered an infidel, including fellow Muslims. Ladies and gentlemen, militant Islam's ambition to dominate the world seems mad. But so too did the global ambitions of another fanatic ideology that swept into power 8 decades ago. The Nazis believed in a master race. The militant Islamists believe in a master faith. They just disagree who among them will be the master of the master faith. That's what they truly disagree about. And therefore, the question before us is whether militant Islam will have the power to realize its unbridled ambitions. There is one place where that could soon happen: the Islamic State of Iran. For 35 years, Iran has relentlessly pursued the global mission which was set forth by its founding ruler, Ayatollah Khomeini, in these words: "We will export our revolution to the entire world until the cry, 'There is no God but Allah,' will echo throughout the world over." And ever since, the regime's brutal enforcers, Iran's revolutionary guards, have done exactly that. Listen to its current commander, General Muhammad Ali Jafri. And he clearly stated this goal. He said, "Our imam did not limit the Islamic revolution to this country. Our duty is to prepare the way for an Islamic world government." Iran's President Rouhani stood here last week and shed crocodile tears over what he called the globalization of terrorism. Maybe he should spare us those phony tears and have a word instead with the commanders of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. He could ask them to call off Iran's global terror campaign, which has included attacks in 24 countries on 5 continents since 2011 alone. You know, to say that Iran doesn't practice terrorism is like saying Derek Jeter never played shortstop for the New York Yankees. This is this bemoaning by the Iranian president of the spread of terrorism has got to be one of history's greatest displays of double talk. Now, some argue that Iran's global terror campaign, its subversion of countries throughout the Middle East and well beyond the Middle East, some argue that this is the work of the extremists. They say things are changing. They point to last year's election in Iran. They claim that Iran's smooth-talking president and foreign minister, they've changed not only the tone of Iran's foreign policy, but also its substance. They believe Rouhani and Zarif generally want to reconcile with the West, that they've abandoned the global mission of the Islamic Revolution. Really? So let's look at what Foreign Minister Zarif wrote in his book just a few years ago. We have a fundamental problem with the West, and especially with America. This is because we are heirs to a global mission, which is tied to our raison d'etre, a global mission which is tied to our very reason for being. And then Zarif asks a question, I think an interesting one. He says, how come Malaysia, he's referring to an overwhelmingly Muslim country, how come Malaysia doesn't have similar problems? And he answers, because Malaysia is not trying to change the international order. That's your moderate. So don't be fooled by Iran's manipulative charm offensive. It's designed for one purpose and for one purpose only: to lift the sanctions and remove the obstacles to Iran's path to the bomb. The Islamic Republic is now trying to bamboozle its way to an agreement that will remove the sanctions it still faces and leave it with the capacity of thousands of refugees, of centrifuges rather, to enrich uranium. This would effectively cement Iran's place as a threshold military nuclear power. And in the future, at the time of its choosing, Iran, the world's most dangerous regime, in the world's most dangerous region, would obtain the world's most dangerous weapons. Allowing that to happen would pose the gravest threat to us all. It's one thing to confront militant Islamists on pickup trucks, armed with Kalashnikov rifles. It's another thing to confront militant Islamists armed with weapons of mass destruction. I remember that last year, everyone here was rightly concerned about the chemical weapons in Syria, including the possibility that they would fall into the hands of terrorists. Well, that didn't happen, and President Obama deserves great credit for leading the diplomatic effort to dismantle virtually all of Syria's chemical weapons capability. Imagine how much more dangerous the Islamic State, ISIS, would be if it possessed chemical weapons. Now imagine how much more dangerous the Islamic State of Iran would be if it possessed nuclear weapons. Ladies and gentlemen, would you let ISIS enrich uranium? Would you let ISIS build a heavy water reactor? Would you let ISIS develop intercontinental ballistic missiles? Of course you wouldn't. Then you mustn't let the Islamic State of Iran do those things either. Because here's what will happen. Once Iran produces atomic bombs, all the charms and all the smiles will suddenly disappear. They'll just vanish. And it's then that the Ayatollahs will show their true face and unleash their aggressive fanaticism on the entire world. There's only one responsible course of action to address this threat. Iran's nuclear military capabilities must be fully dismantled. Make no mistake, ISIS must be defeated. But to defeat ISIS and leave Iran as a threshold nuclear power is to win the battle and lose the war. To defeat ISIS and leave Iran as a threshold nuclear power is to win the battle and lose the war. Ladies and gentlemen, the fight against militant Islam is indivisible. When militant Islam succeeds anywhere, it's emboldened everywhere. When it suffers a blow in one place, it's set back in every place. That's why Israel's fight against Hamas is not just our fight, it's your fight. Israel is fighting a fanaticism today that your countries may be forced to fight tomorrow. For 50 days this past summer, Hamas fired thousands of rockets at Israel, many of them supplied by Iran. I want you to think about what your countries would do if thousands of rockets were fired at your cities. Imagine millions of your citizens having seconds at most to scramble to bomb shelters day after day. You wouldn't let terrorists fire rockets at your cities with impunity. Nor would you let terrorists dig dozens of terror tunnels under your borders to infiltrate your towns in order to murder and kidnap your citizens. Israel justly defended itself against both rocket attacks and terror tunnels. Yet Israel faced another challenge. We faced a propaganda war, because in an attempt to win the world's sympathy, Hamas cynically used Palestinian civilians as human shields. It used schools, not just schools, UN schools, private homes, mosques, even hospitals, to store and fire rockets at Israel. As Israel surgically struck at the rocket launchers and at the tunnels, Palestinian civilians were tragically but unintentionally killed. There are heart-rending images that resulted, and these fueled libelous charges that Israel was deliberately targeting civilians. We were not. We deeply regret every single civilian casualty. And the truth is this: Israel was doing everything to minimize Palestinian civilian casualties. Hamas was doing everything to maximize Israeli civilian casualties and Palestinian civilian casualties. Israel dropped flyers, made phone calls, sent text messages, broadcast warnings in Arabic on Palestinian television, all this to enable Palestinian civilians to evacuate targeted areas. No other country and no other army in history have gone to greater lengths to avoid casualties among the civilian population of their enemies. Now, This concern for Palestinian life was all the more remarkable, given that Israeli civilians were being bombarded by rockets day after day, night after night. And as their families were being rocketed by Hamas, Israel's citizen army, the brave soldiers of the IDF, our young boys and girls, they upheld the highest moral values of any army in the world. Israel's soldiers deserve not condemnation, but admiration. Admiration from decent people everywhere. Now here's what Hamas did. Hamas embedded its missile batteries in residential areas and told Palestinians to ignore Israel's warnings to leave. And just in case people didn't get the message, they executed Palestinian civilians in Gaza who dared to protest. And no less reprehensible, Hamas deliberately placed its rockets where Palestinian children live and play. Let me show you a photograph. It was taken by a France 24 crew during the recent conflict. It shows two Hamas rocket launchers, which were used to attack us. You see three children playing next to them. Hamas deliberately put its rockets in hundreds of residential areas like this, hundreds of them. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a war crime. And I say to President Abbas, these are the crimes, the war crimes, committed by your Hamas partners in the National Unity Government which you head and you are responsible for. And these are the real war crimes you should have investigated or spoken out against from this podium last week. Ladies and gentlemen, as Israel's children huddle in bomb shelters and Israel's Iron Dome missile defense knocked Hamas rockets out of the sky, the profound moral difference between Israel and Hamas couldn't have been clearer. Israel was using its missiles to protect its children. Hamas was using its children to protect its missiles. By investigating Israel rather than Hamas for war crimes, the UN Human Rights Council has betrayed its noble mission to protect the innocent. In fact, what it's doing is to turn the laws of war upside down. Israel, which took unprecedented steps to minimize civilian casualties, Israel is condemned. Hamas, which both targeted and hid behind civilians, that's a double war crime. Hamas is given a pass. The Human Rights Council is thus sending a clear message to terrorists everywhere. Use civilians as a human shield. Use them again and again and again. And you know why? Because sadly, it works. By granting international legitimacy to the use of human shields, the UN Human Rights Council has thus become a terrorist rights council. And it will have repercussions. It probably already has. About the use of civilians as human shields. It's not just our interests. It's not just our values that are under attack. It's your interests and your values. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in a world steeped in tyranny and terror, where gays are hanged from cranes in Tehran, political prisoners are executed in Gaza, young girls are abducted en masse in Nigeria, and hundreds of thousands are butchered in Syria, Libya, and Iraq.
And after a beautiful, beautiful speech of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, we cannot give you a whole of it at length because it's longer, but the sense of the matter is you understand what we're facing. Today, America is facing the same situation with the fight against ISIS. It's trying to consider how to bombard their bases without hurting the population. It's the same trick of the book that Hamas used before Human Rights Council of United Nations. It is supporting Hamas. It's actually gave a go to ISIS to do the same. And right now we are in the same situation globally. And America, the leader of the free world, is facing the same situation. Coalition of the willing is something that they need to understand that how to go about it. There is no tricks in the book, you know, to save those lives. Those lives are being used as a weapon against the West because they know our value system. They know the people care. We care about children more than anything, and we want them safe. And by them hiding behind them, they're actually committing a big war crime, of course, but not that they care. But they're creating a situation that they cannot be defeated, ultimately. However, this time, I think that the world is going to overcome them because everybody has to come to their senses. You know, staying on the, you know, on the fence, as Turkey been doing, trying to cater to both sides, won't work for long. Because now they are on Turkey border and the Turkey military is sitting there and they promise, they actually legislated a law in their in the recent days that stated that, you know, foreign boots can be on the ground. But instead, today they negated it. They told America that they cannot allow it, which something that, they, again, they double-faced. They are friends of Iran, friends of Syria, they're friends of all the enemy of the Western world, and they still belong to NATO, and they still have the protection of the West, and they still have the, you know, the accommodation of our civilization. But we need to reconsider. We need to see if they come to the plate and play this role, because the repercussions are incredible. And this Islamic world government, which will never exist because it's based on debt. If it will exist, it will be all debt. So we cannot let it be. And it's not going to become a problem of, you know, Turkey or Syria. It's a problem of all of us everywhere because they want to take over the world. Let's go to a break. And let's go back and start to focusing about what's really we care about, God. And we are back, and it's never give up is the story of our life, I guess, that we cannot give up on this world, this beautiful world that we created. And we try to talk about education as the foundation of knowledge and understanding. And knowledge is something that make a difference between the Western world and the rest of the world that still need to contemplate. Maybe it's our fault that we didn't go and created a better world for them to understand and educate them so they can come to the level and, you know, come to be a part of the Western world. But we neglected that. And we, of course, need to understand that it's all in our capacity to try to reverse all this action. That goose that got out of the box needs to actually disappear. We need to make them run to their holes again and just vanish. And it's because we care. We care about this world because it's not our world to destroy. This is a world that God created, and we need to make it better. We need to make sure that we're doing our part. Our life is dedicated to be a part of this world. And there is one God, and it's all our God, and we're all fighting for nothing because at the end of the day, if there is God, you know, of, they call it in different names. It's always one God. So the scoop of the end of days will be one God. And that's why I think that we need to focus on what's really happening in Jerusalem these days. We are in the middle of the Jewish holiday of Tabernacle. Tabernacle, you know, Sukkot is a holiday that everybody came to Jerusalem. It's one of the three major holidays that the Jewish people, the Hebrew, came to Jerusalem to give grace before God. And we need to understand that right now the holy places of all in Jerusalem is Temple Mount, of course. And if there is any place that's been occupied by the Muslims, is Temple Mount, because it's the holy site for all the world. It's not only for Islam, it's not only for the Jewish people, it's not only for Christians, it's for all the world. So because it's the center of gravity and it's the center of all conflict, and it's the amazing, amazing place that God put together to test us all to come to be as one before Him, we need to pay attention to what's going on there. Jews, of course, can descend the mount, but sometimes between, you know, a very short period of time every day, if there is no stoning or rioting of the Muslim or any aggravated assault to policemen from the side of the Waqf and the Muslims' brothers that, you know, worship God, worship everything, but they don't worship humanity. They don't care for humanity, because another man, another woman from a different brand of life or brand, different entity, they will collide. They will do everything just to remove them from the place. So there is no space for any Jewish people to come to build their temple, of course, and it's supposed to be one side by side. They need to understand that nobody wants to get anything, you know, from them. They just want to come and pray before God. And on this holiday, it's so important to come and descend the mount, and they close the mount because they're writing. They close the mount because people know that there are stones there. They collect. They put flags of terrorist organization against the peace accord with Jordan and Israel. They don't respect holy places, and God is deserve a place in the world to be, you know, to be united with all His children, I guess. So we need to work out some plan. And there was a few people that were talking that, you know, it might be a good thing to consider a multi-religious conference, because it's time to say quit. You know, okay, we got the gig, we got you all, we need to stop it. Because at the end of the day, they're going to destroy all their countries, because they're going one by one. And, you know, America has the capacity to go and bombard everything if they insist, you know, but why to do that? You know, anybody can tell them, you know, just please stop. It's enough. With the world, it's really pathetic to even imagine that they will listen. But we need to try to come to a grip. There are other moderate people that can come and before others and try to understand. But, you know, something about moderate people, you know, that I listen on Fox News that really, really concern me when they talk about Islam. They said, you know, 9/11 was made by how many, 19 people only? Excuse me? 19 people. It doesn't matter. It's a force. They destroyed thousands of lives. How can you even say something like that? It's important to understand that even those moderate, they are using, you know, they're trying to diminish the wrongful doing of the militant Islam. They're trying to protect them, and every time they do that, they just empower them. They are enforcing them, and they're collaborating with them because they covered their back. anytime you hear a modern Islamic, you know, scholar, like I listened to it yesterday, he was saying, you know, there are only a few people who did destroy it. Yes, of course, but there is only one person who can push one button in Iran to make the nuclear capability happen. So are we going to dismantle it or not? It's only one man, but he's going to push the button. So we need to eliminate Iran nuclear capability. We need to defeat ISIS. We need to get rid of militant Islam. We need to stand up for the world and for God and for the freedom of everyone, every soul on this earth. Let's go to a break. All right, and we are at the end of the show. This is Orly Benny Davis on BBS Radio. This is The Impossible Truth. The impossible truth to tell, but it is the truth. It's the situation that we're all facing. It's the situation that people have to create a new life, a new way, you know, with global collapse of the economy, that everybody is restarting again. So let's start again in a good world. Let's start again to do right. Let's stop being, you know, greedy and want everything. Let's enjoy what we have, the life that God gave us, the love that we all share, the brotherhood of man that we really, really cherish, and we can have it again if we don't need to, you know, double play anybody. We can be, you know, upfront and honest with each other. I know it's something, it's a poetic or some kind of cliche to say, but there is another way. You know, everybody tried the rest. Now let's try the right way. We had the book to give us the way of living, the Bible. And, you know, for some reason, people say that the Quran is a peaceful religion. But the problem is that the interpretation of the basic book never been evolved. Like the Bible. The Bible got involved. Of course, there are stories, horrible stories in the Bible of a situation that, you know, you don't predict. But the Jewish people don't follow it. You know, the Christian people don't follow that. They evolved. They interpreted it from the message it sent. It sent, or the lesson we learned. So we need to understand that we need to help them evolve to the next level as people. We cannot decide that we don't have to deal with it. This is their problem, and you know we're just gonna dismantle all the power and everything. It's not gonna help at the end of the day. We need to come together as one. This world was created. All those people are people of God. Everybody is our children of God. So we need to deal with them. Sometimes we have people, children that we don't like to deal with, but this is our life. This is our world. We need to. So maybe we can start understanding. Maybe one day everyone try to reach out to another, make it better. And if we just pray to God to help us, maybe He will listen. Maybe He will listen because it's time that we enjoyed the world he created. So, again, this is Orly Benny Davis on BBS Radio with The Impossible Truth. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope that we can talk again. And next week, please join in. The number here, it's 888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. So next week, maybe we'll get some calls so we can talk about the issue on your mind. And maybe we'll have some people that we can start an understanding. So thank you, Doug, for your cooperation. Thank you, BBS Radio. I love you. And I hope to talk to you, God willing, in happiness next week. Chag Sameach to everybody. Happy Sukkot, all the Jewish people. And may God bless you all. Thank you. Bye-bye.